I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One guy wrote like last year like that he just didn't like my face. Said, watching Welcome Sweden, it's okay, I just can't stand this, the main character's face, or something like that. And for some reason, I can't stop thinking about that tweet. Like...
Hello and welcome to Varvet International. I'm Kristoffer Triumf. I'm in Los Angeles having a great time. I long to share these interviews with you. There's many great talks to come, so please make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And please do that via the Acast app, if that's available in your country, or any other podcasting service you use, like iTunes, for instance. I would also like to tell you that Varvet is sponsored by Uber. It's like having a private driver at your service, like three clicks away on your iPhone. And if you are a listener in Sweden and you don't have an Uber account, you should get one. And if you use Varvet as your referral code, you will get 150 kroner to Uber for. So get that account and try Uber, whichever big city you are in. But use the code Varvet in Sweden. It works in Stockholm and Gothenburg. Thanks so much, Uber. So my guest today is Greg Poehler, creator, showrunner, and lead star of the hit series Welcome to Sweden. And he's truly a self-made man. When I first met him like 3 or 4 years ago, we both were trying stand-up for the first times. And just a year or two later, his TV series came out in Sweden and became a huge success with over 1 million viewers. That's pretty great for a population of 9.6 million. And then his show was picked up by the NBC here in the US. And this is sort of unheard of, that a Swedish show makes it to prime time television here in the US. The show Welcome to Sweden is co-produced by Greg's sister Amy Poehler. Yes, the Amy Poehler, lead star of my fave show Parks and Recreation, known from Saturday Night Live and host of the 2015 Golden Globes. That's that Amy Poehler. And in a while, we'll get into how it feels to be the younger brother of, well, one of the funniest people on earth. If you haven't seen Greg Poehler's series Welcome to Sweden, here's a really rough outline. A New York lawyer, that's Greg, but in the series he's named Bruce. He meets a Swedish girl and moves to her home country. It bears resemblance to Greg's own life, to say the least, and he has an amazing cast in it. Lena Olin, Ileana Douglas, Amy Poehler, and so forth. And when I sat down with Greg a couple of weeks ago, he was just in the middle of shooting season two of his series. So, let's roll the tape. It's from Vällingby in February 2015. Here's Greg Poehler.
How are you today, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for having me in your lovely abode.
But you told me that you were hungover today because you had...
Yes. Well, I'd like to, you know, I want my voice to be as sexy as possible during these things. So it's a choice I made. Now, we had our... we're halfway through production of second season, so we had our... I don't even know what you would call that in English. It's meatfest in Swedish.
But yeah, midfest.
Middle party.
actually, when I wrote it down, autocorrect suggested midfest, so...
Oh, really? Midfest. I don't know.
Well, it's a party, and it's in the middle of production.
Yes, Maybe we don't have them in the US because we have no name for it.
Well, yeah, and maybe you shouldn't have either. This might be a bit, what do you call it, a judgmental on Swedes, but my picture is that we're good workers in a way, but we also work less than Americans.
Definitely, yeah. And celebrate when you're only halfway finished, apparently.
Exactly, yeah.
No, I think Swedes are very efficient with their time, but also would never give up like their weekends and holidays and things like that. Whereas, I mean, I worked in New York as a lawyer for 6 years, and I worked every weekend and never really thought about not working those weekends. Yeah. It's just kind of an accepted way of life. Whereas here, you know, a lot of the lawyers that I know here, even the ones that work a lot, they don't work weekends. Hardly ever.
How long was an average work week in New York?
Well, I chose to come home at night and then work weekends. That was kind of the choice. So I would say it was between like 9 and 9, Monday through Friday, and then 5 or 6 hours on the weekends days. That was my.
That's too much.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for looking out for me. Yeah. You get paid a lot though, so.
Yeah.
I mean, it becomes your life when you're in that environment.
We were discussing that. I've spent some time in Los Angeles now, and we've been discussing that someone should start a Swedish, like a carpenter service for renovating houses and so forth. Because in general, I'm not sure that this is true anymore, but people tend to be on time in Sweden. And and I mean, if they say something is going to be finished by a date, it's probably going to be finished by that date, mm-hmm. and so forth. I've understood that that's not the case in Los Angeles anyway.
Okay. Well, there's your business idea then. The Swedish handyman is what you're trying to?
Yeah, exactly.
Import?
Yeah.
Just punctual and not very good, but gets it done on time.
Yeah, and use loads of pine. As you see, we're crazy
about
that.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. Okay, so we actually know each other a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
I think we met the first time when you were sort of in pre-production of your show.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we had a coffee, but that wasn't the first time.
No, I think we met when I was doing stand-up, actually.
Mm. Because we sort of... do you remember the date of your first gig?
No.
But it was...
Do you? Maybe. That might have been...
Not of yours.
That's what I meant. Are you keeping track of me? No, I don't. I actually have no idea.
No.
I think it was December of some year.
Okay, yeah. I would guess
12,
it, yeah,
maybe?
Exactly. Something like that. Because my first was September 2012, I think. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps October. And then we sort of met in the Stockholm stand-up scene.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't go through with that. I sort of dropped out.
Uh-huh.
But you kept doing it.
I do it from time to time. I wouldn't say I'm a stand-up. I mean, I do it very infrequently, especially now when I'm shooting the show. But
of course, yeah.
No, I still do it periodically, but I still don't feel like I've ever really devoted the time required for it.
How come? Well, you're a family man. You have three children.
Yeah, exactly.
And you had two when, or is that correct?
Right, yeah, just my third is two now, so just turned two. Yeah, I would love to do it some. I would love to spend some time and try to actually master that. But yeah, it's tricky with money and all. It's not exactly a money-making venture, or can be, I guess, but there's easier ways.
But don't you have a really rich wife?
Where have you heard that?
I don't know, but she's a lawyer, right?
Wait a minute, I'm interested in how you came to that
conclusion.
Because she's a lawyer, she's really really rich. She's a Swedish lawyer, so
yeah. But she used to work in the U.S.
Yeah,
yeah.
So did I. That's how we met.
I don't know. I just thought that you guys had loads of cash laying around at home.
We do. We have lots of just random cash. We sleep in a bed of money.
You do?
I do. Yeah. My side of the bed is filled with money. Yeah. No, yeah.
Okay.
She makes a fine living, but yeah, I need to also bring home some money.
And at your level of comedy, stand-up comedy, that's not the case.
Well, I mean, I shouldn't say that. I mean, I have made some money off of my comedy, but I just haven't. I don't know. I'm at the stage now where I've kind of I want to just retire all of my jokes and start over.
I totally get that feeling.
Yeah. And I haven't spent the time to do it. So then when I get asked to do gigs, it's just like, oh, I guess I can do it, but I'm just going to, I hope no one's there that has seen me before because it's going to be the same stuff.
Yeah. I must say that I was impressed with you because since I was sort of a fan of your sisters, I know you get this a lot, but I was curious with you, of course, when, mm-hmm. when I heard that you were to try out stand-up comedy. But I was really impressed with your sort of natural confidence on stage.
Mm, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's nice. Yeah, I don't really get nervous in much of anything, in really any situation. I don't know where that comes from, but it certainly helps in that realm. I mean, the crazy thing is, you know, I like I said, when you say stand, like, I don't really consider myself a stand-up because I do it so infrequently, and I really respect people who do it as their life and living, and I know quite a few stand-ups, especially Americans, and that's such a grind, and it's a really all-day job, so I don't consider myself one. But yet, last year I was Variety Magazine's, you know, top 10 comics to watch in 2014, so I was there performing at... in Montreal, it's Just for Laughs Festival with, you know, 9 other fantastic comedians, all of whom were, you know, I think we had to do 15 minutes each, and they were all doing like their best 15 minutes that they've kind of honed and crafted for however many years. And I was just doing like 15 minutes that was my non-Swedish stuff. the only 15 minutes of jokes that didn't involve like American living in Sweden.
But at least you had 15 minutes.
I kind of did some crowd work as well.
Okay.
I had probably 12 minutes. I went fine, but it was interesting to be in that setting and feel maybe that it didn't quite belong there. But I guess I'm a comic to watch.
Yeah.
For at least last year, maybe this year. You can stop watching. I don't know. I mean, I feel, part of me feels that I feel like I'm a good comedian. I feel like I'm rarely great, if ever. Partly because I don't have the... I think in order to be a great comedian, you have to really need it. Like you need the laughs. There's certain people you see in life and on stage that just need it. They need that. You know, they'll go anywhere to get that laugh. And I don't have that. If they're not laughing, I'm just like, yeah, all right.
Okay.
Good. That's it for me, people. Yeah, I don't know. I maybe I'm too well adjusted. I think to be a great comedian.
We are at the same age. We're both 40. I have like 6 months ahead of the start of you.
Congratulations.
Life-wise.
How is it for you being 40?
Well, it's okay. But and the days are numbered now. I mean, in 9 days, I'm going to be 41. So.
Oh, I thought you meant... okay. I thought you meant you were dying soon.
Well, I hope
days,
not.
Our days are numbered.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know what number it is, though.
41, perhaps.
Well, yeah.
Just take it 1 year at a time. No, yeah, I'm having a bit of a... Are you having any sort of, like, midlife crisis? Or?
Well, I'm Googling Rolexes far too much.
that's the extent of your crisis?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to run the marathon. It's always been kind of a... For the last like 20 years, I've been telling people I'm going to run one marathon when I turn 40, and now it's here. And as soon as I turned 40, I got, you know, 20 emails and texts like, "Here we go, there it is, marathon year." So I'm signed up at least for the Stockholm Marathon. So I'm training now while shooting my show.
Is that why you ran here?
I did not run here, but
no, but you came walking in.
Yeah, there was no parking spot, so I had to go park around the corner. Okay. That'd be funny if I'd read. So, yeah, I have some creaky 40-year-old knees that are acting up, but hopefully I'll cross that finish line.
It's just 42 kilometers, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. At all at once. Apparently you can't stop.
Well,
or maybe you can. I don't know.
I'm not sure. But
how do you feel? I mean, you're changing careers. What were you doing before?
I was in advertising.
Mm.
I realized that I... needed to be more in center of attention.
Yeah.
I actually provoked people by saying that it's time for me to get famous now.
Uh-huh. That's a good goal. To start with that. That's like my kid's goal. You know, I've ever watched like all these kid shows these days. Nicola's just like, I just want to be famous.
Yeah.
It's like there's just a bunch of kids that are famous and as this the plot for all of these.
I know. And someone talked about that the other day that I was hearing and listening to a podcast, I think, and that the old Andy Warhol quote about everybody being famous for 15 minutes in the future, that's, I mean, we've passed that. And in their minds, everybody are famous now because they sort of have Instagram and they have...
Yeah.
Twitter and their opinions matter super much to them. Mm. So nobody thinks that why should you spend like 10,000 hours learning something when I'm already a superstar?
Yeah. I think also just the fact that everyone's on screen all the time. Mm. And I know with my kids, they're not overly impressed when I'm on television.
No.
Because they can be on it as well if they just set the camera up right. Or if they're calling their grandparents, you know, they see themselves on the screen. So I think it's lost a bit of its magic to that generation. But I don't know. I mean, for me, it's... I'm petrified. I mean, changing careers this late in life was like probably the scariest thing I've done. It's still scary for me. I feel like I'm working much harder at this job than I did at my old job because I have kind of everything on the line. I don't think I can go back.
Why?
Going back would just be like, just that feeling of failure.
Yeah, but you do have the education and so forth.
Yeah, so I know, but it's just, I don't know, there's something about going back that would just be supremely depressing.
Is there some part of you that that regrets, that is regretful about changing career or taking the step?
No, not at all. I just am scared in the sense, I mean, as a lawyer, you know, it's pretty safe career in the sense you know exactly where it's going to go and you can kind of map out your next 40 years.
Were you a partner at the... firm?
No, I was I was in New York for 6 years, so I didn't quite. Usually around the eighth or ninth year is when you become a partner, and then here I was just working with a bunch of American lawyers who married Swedes.
Yeah, and that wasn't because you did something else, right, in Sweden. You weren't in court.
No, yeah. I mean, you kind of can't you pretty much have to go back and do the whole Swedish law thing if you want to go that route, which I couldn't do. So in some ways it was easier. The move to Sweden was kind of like a middle step away from my old career. So I don't think I would have even dared to do it if we were in the States. But this kind of, it was the first step towards a new life anyway, and you know, might as well go all the way. But I'm super scared. I mean, I still, especially because in this business, I mean, once the... Like I said, you can't map out. I don't know what's, you know, if this show ends, if this is the final season, then it's scary. I mean, I'm writing a movie and developing another show, but don't know if that's going to happen. I mean, it could be a period of total nothingness.
You said that you wouldn't have dared to try in the US, but could you have done it in New York?
No. Well, it would have been too much to give up, I think, too, in terms of the job. You know, it was making so much money there that I think it would have been impossible to come home to my wife and say, I want to do comedy.
That money, you didn't obviously stuff it in the mattress.
No, that's the money that's on my bed.
Okay.
That I'm rolling around. No, so, I mean, yeah, that was kind of, I don't know. I would like to think that I would have, but it's also... I think the opportunity there, there's so many people doing that there. It just feels like you'd be one in a million.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the prospect of that never really appealed to me, of like starting from the bottom. And I think if I had done the same thing in the US, if I had written the same show, if we were living in New York and I wrote Welcome to Sweden and pitched it to someone in LA, I think maybe they would have bought it, but they wouldn't have let me play the role, I don't think. Or be involved in the show at all. Just you know, paid me for it and moved on with some other more famous actor. So it was great. I mean, I to go the Hollywood route through Sweden, this is really the only place that it could happen for me, I think.
Let's take it back to the beginning, and we'll get to the present in a way.
Excuse me.
You were born in Boston.
Yeah, basically.
Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Super hard to pronounce.
Yeah, I know. I like the way you did it, though. It was good. Have you been practicing?
A little bit.
That was good.
Was it even perfect?
It was perfect, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And that was a little bit more than 40 years ago.
I've been told. I don't remember that exact moment, but yes.
What do you know about your birth?
About the actual day of it?
Well, yeah.
Not much. I mean, I know my mom always talks about that in those days, they literally knocked the woman out. Like they gave them some sort of crazy drug cocktail.
Okay.
So they were passed out when the babies came out, which is fascinating.
Yeah, that's really fascinating.
How it was a 70s trend. No pain, but you don't remember it.
Okay, it wasn't a Caesar.
No, it was a natural birth, but I mean, I'm sure that she was conscious, but doesn't remember anything. It was in some sort of like fog.
Was your dad in there?
I would assume so, but I'm not sure in the room.
Okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. I actually don't know much about my birthday.
Next time you're on the show, I want to know more.
Yeah, let's just talk about that.
Yeah.
But I came out totally naked, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unprepared.
Yeah.
And your parents were, or perhaps even are, teachers?
Yeah, they were. My mom was a teacher until she retired. My dad was a teacher for the first, 10 years of my life. And then he started doing different kind of sales things. But they're both retired now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Living still in Massachusetts.
Yes. Look at you. You nailed it again.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. They live in the same house, actually, that we grew up in.
Okay.
I've lived in the same house. They've been in the same house my whole life.
The town isn't Boston.
It's Burlington.
Okay.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about that place?
It's a suburb about 20 minutes outside of Boston. Very, I would say, low middle class. I think a typical American suburb in many ways. Very self-sufficient. You know, it has like lots of business and restaurants there. So people just tend to stay there and not venture into the city even very much.
And Boston, what I haven't been there. What kind of place is that? I know that there are loads of Irish cops there.
Yeah, Boston's a mix of the cultural elite from these, universities with the old school Irish Catholic hard nose crowd. So it's an interesting place in that sense. I don't think I quite ever fit in there, I would say, with that mentality. Even though I am Irish and my grandparents and grew up Catholic. So I guess I did fit in anyways.
Yeah.
But Boston has an attitude of kind of like, you think you're better than me? Like that's, and a lot of fights, unnecessary fights, I would say. Like if you're just walking in a bar and like bump into someone, hey, what do you think? And challenged to a fight 5 seconds later outside.
So it was like that for you as well. That sounds like Sweden.
Maybe. I mean, I was always really good at talking my way out of fights. I think that's how I developed a lot of maybe my comedy. It's in those scary moments when somebody's challenged you to a fight on your way out to the door. You can try to turn them with a joke or two.
And there's a Boston dialect as well.
Yes. I had the Boston accent. Yeah, I still have it every now and then. It when I'm watching the dailies of my show, there are times when I hear it. It sneaks in.
How is that? What does it sound like?
Anytime there's an R, you just don't really pronounce it. Like hard instead of hard.
Oh, okay. So I have a hard on.
I have a hard on.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't.
But I do. That's why I said it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Boston accents make me horny.
And what was your upbringing like? Who were you?
I was, I actually have thought a lot about this after I made the career change, because I've never actually been in therapy. I've never seen a therapist. I've never talked too much about my upbringing or myself. So I've never really had to examine who I was. But for me, very early on, I peaked as a person in terms of intelligence and status really early. Like I was reading at 2 years old at a really like intense level where one of my earliest memories is my parents brought in these people to like test me for like genius stuff.
Okay.
They didn't quite know what to do with this kid who could do all this stuff at 2 years old. So I used to have all these people coming into the house and giving me stuff. Like I can remember that extremely vividly. So I started school early at like 4.
You were like 2 years younger than your
parents? Yeah, a year plus.
Okay.
And same thing. I remember the first day of like, kindergarten, you know, the teacher forcing me up there to read a book, Where the Wild Things Are, in front of the other kids. This is kind of like, check out this dude. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I kind of peaked then, I think. It's been a steady decline. But so I kind of always felt that pressure, I think, of people expecting me to be like the smart kid and not necessarily what others labeled, maybe what I labeled myself because of that. And it's not actually a healthy thing to have that from a very early on, like, oh, I'm special. That feeling, it can do some damage, I think.
In what way?
I mean, it's good for your self-confidence, but I think it's, you know, if I'm looking back on how I was, I think there was a lot of people from that time that I went to school with that would be like, oh my God, I could not stand that guy. Because I thought I was better than them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Enough people tell you it, you start to believe it yourself. And I think it also kind of made me lazy because school came very easy to me at a young age. And it just seemed like it was going to be a breeze and I didn't have to work at it. And then once the rest of everybody else caught up to me, I didn't have any work ethic whatsoever. So I really had to restart that almost at like 16, where I finally started actually studying.
Okay, yeah.
Prior to that, it was all just easy.
Okay. And you had like straight days up until then?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, so I think like that was kind of my role, I think, in the family. I think my sister was allowed to be a little bit more... She did well in school as well, so it wasn't like she was a bad student, but I always kind of felt that pressure, like, you know, she's gonna do whatever, but you have to do something with this. And I think with you know, a lower middle class family, it's very important, like the job, you know, thing is, you know, get a good job, make a lot of money, provide for your family. And if you're good in school, everybody is pushing you, like, you know, you have to, don't waste this, you know, use it, find a job where the being good at school applies. And so in many ways, it kind of felt mapped out for me, I think, in that sense. I kind of knew I wanted to go the law school route fairly early on, even in high school.
Why? How did you get that idea?
Well, I think, you know, I was just looking for, like I said, you know, it's kind of it's an institutional kind of thing. If you do well in school, you get into a good law school, you get a good job as a lawyer, you make a lot of money, you become a partner. I can see it. It's one of those things where, you know, your ability in school can get you there.
Yeah. But so,
and that's what I was interested in.
I mean, you could have become a medical doctor as well.
Yeah, I'm not really into
cutting people,
helping people. No, never interested me. I'm not a science guy at all.
Okay. But a money guy.
Not so much money. I mean, it was more just, it just seemed like a secure way to get where I wanted to be.
But in high school and so forth, you weren't a nerd, right? You were...
No. Well, I shouldn't say that. I guess, you know, no, I wouldn't say that. No, I was also really good at sports, which helped socially. So I was a really good basketball player, tennis player.
But you were fairly short.
Yeah, thank you for that.
But you were good in basket anyway.
Yeah, my father was also shorter, and he was a fantastic basketball player in college. So that rubbed off a bit. Yeah.
All right.
I mean, it was a, you know, white suburban league. So it's, you don't have to be too tall to play there.
Yeah. Boston feels like a baseball place to me for some reason.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you good at that as well?
I was a good baseball player, yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds very, now I'm reverting back into my But yeah, I'm good. Any sport with a ball, I think I'm pretty good. I get good hand-eye coordination. So yeah, I did that, and I think you know, when high school came around, I was kind of rebelling a bit against what I was earlier on in life. So I got into a lot of trouble in high school.
Okay, for smoking weed?
No, there was no weed in our high school. We missed it.
How come?
Just drinking.
That sounds strange.
I know. It was it's like late 80s, early 90s. And it was just a dry period in the town. Yeah. I don't know. There was weed before us and after us, but okay. Not while we were there.
Strange.
College is when I really started getting into that.
All right. We were at who you were in school. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if I would recognize that kid anymore in some ways. But I was, yeah, so I was kind of all over the place in terms of, I did well in school, but was kind of hanging with, you know, a slightly more rebellious crowd, drinking a lot in the woods, getting chased by policemen, sometimes getting caught.
Even that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had some run-ins with the local law enforcement. I mean, that's what, at that time at least, you know, that's what the Boston suburbs were, was, you know, kids who got chased by policemen became the policemen and uh-huh. chased and chased. The chasers became the chasees or vice versa. And that's what the only crime in the town was, underage drinking, you know. So the entire force was just involved in trying to find kids in the woods.
Did you get like a fine for that or something like that?
Yeah, well, I got caught a couple of times. I had to go to these like classes. Instead of, I could have gone to court, but instead they had this like, almost like drug and alcohol treatment stuff. That all the, it was just a bunch of teenagers who got caught in the woods.
Okay.
Sitting around being forced to watch videos and talk about their lives.
And that's when you decided to be a lawyer.
That's when I said, yeah, I could make some money off of people like myself.
Yeah. 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 You said that you were good in sports, but that wasn't like, was that a passion of you?
Yeah, I mean, there was times. I mean, I wasted so much time on basketball in particular. It just drives me crazy when I think back on it. You know, the amount of hours. I mean, I still can shoot, and you know, but it's a skill that otherwise doesn't come in handy very often.
No,
I play a lot of tennis now with my wife, who's a good player, so that still kind of works, but
on your tennis court in the garden.
Yes, our gold
of your
gold tennis court
of your mansion. Yeah. But you do live in like Danderyd or something, some posh neighborhood, right?
Yeah,
Stocksund.
Yeah,
you see,
I know you really want me to be filthy rich for the purposes of this.
I'm not sure why, but
yeah, we do all right. I mean, it's my wife's neighborhood that she grew up in, actually.
Okay.
A few houses down from where she grew up, which is kind of weird.
For her, yeah.
For her, yeah. Yeah. Not for me. It's all new to me.
Yeah. Well, not now. You moved here in 96 or something.
No. 2006.
2006.
Yeah.
Right. You moved here in 2006.
Yeah, but we lived in the city for the first 5 years. Mm. So we moved 3 years ago to a house.
I was sort of stalking you before you started doing comedy.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that why I'm here right now?
Well, no.
What do you mean by that?
No, but, you know, it started, the rumor was sort of out because I'm not sure which forum that was in, but when we sort of, now, anyway, I'm on a Facebook group called Comedy Nerds or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a rumor about Amy Poehler's brother living in Sweden, and and you were sort of in the phone book or something like that. So it was actually possible to Google you,
mm-hmm.
but it stopped at that. I didn't, so if you had any like, well, syringes in the mailbox or so, that wasn't
you?
Me.
No. Okay, that's kind of a soft stalk then.
Well, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
It was all Google.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for admitting that. That's very kind.
Well, yeah. I am an honest dude. But anyway, what were your dreams growing up? Did you dream of being a Manhattan lawyer?
Oh, I don't really. Well, I mean, I think that's what this whole career change has kind of shown me, is that I really didn't spend much time actually thinking about what I wanted to do. It was more what was expected of me in many ways. So I kind of followed that path and was on that path and probably would have been on that path for the rest of my life if it weren't for moving here, actually, to Sweden, which kind of gave me a step away from that life anyway. And then actually the whole thing changed. I mean, when I decided to do stand-up, it was something that I'd always wanted to do, actually, forever.
Because you were a comedy fan.
Yeah, huge.
Growing up.
Huge. I mean, especially stand-up. I was really into it.
Did you have stand-up comedy, like televised stand-up comedy, when you grew up? Or was it like...
Yeah, well, I used to... I still maintain, whenever anybody asks about my sister and I, about, you know, were you guys a funny family or were your parents funny? I think... For both of us, I think the vast majority of our comedic sensibility comes from the fact that our parents let us have televisions in our bedroom and didn't monitor when we were, we were watching it. So we watched everything growing up. And I used to watch Johnny Carson's show, The Tonight Show. It starts at 11:30 at night, by the way. Mm. I watched it almost every night. I would have the TV on. My parents would come in. I would pretend like I was asleep. They would shut it off and they'd go to their bedroom. I'd wait a few seconds and then turn it back on. Mm. And I always watched his monologue at least before I went to bed. So this is, again, I was probably getting like 5 hours sleep during my middle school and high school days.
That's why you're so short.
No, I'm not so short. You're very tall.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. You were average, I would say.
I'm average, yeah.
179?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Can you guess my weight as well? Or?
70.
Wow. You're way off on that.
What is it?
It's more closer to like 85 or something.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But thank you.
You're welcome. You have a fat back.
That's right. I melt on my ankles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it all changed when I decided to do stand-up. And even that, I was expecting just to be like something I did on the side for fun.
The first time you went up on stage, you still were working at the law firm here,
yeah,
in Stockholm. Yeah. Did you have a plan about Welcome to Sweden? I mean, the
no,
show.
No, not at all. Well, similar to the stand-up thing, it was always something that I had been thinking about, but had never planned on doing anything about. So I had a friend, actually, an American friend, who I said I wanted to maybe do some stand-up. And but actually, to go back a little further, when I made the decision to finally do stand-up is when Aziz Ansari came here to Stockholm. And we went out for lunch. He asked me whether I had ever gotten into comedy, and I told him this story, which is true, which is when my sister was in graduated college, she moved to Chicago and went to Improv Olympic in Second City.
Yeah.
And I was planning on joining her comedy troupe. Yeah, we went to the same college, Boston College. It's called My Mother's Fleabag. It's like a improv group. And I was going to try out for that. But first, in the summer, I went to visit her in Chicago. And the shows that I saw there were so amazingly good that I literally went home and was like, I'm never going to be anywhere near that. And those people are nobodies, you know, they're all working as waiters and waitresses. So what's the point? You know, I can't even get to that level, which is nowhere. And it turns out, I mean, all those people went on to, I mean, it was Amy and Tina Fey and Steve Carell and Stephen Colbert, Horatio Sanz, Dave Koechner. Those are the people I was watching.
Yeah.
I mean, if you would have told me the time, and no, these are the best in the world at it, I probably would have tried out. So I was telling Aziz that story, and he said to me, oh, really? I have the opposite story. You know, the first time I saw someone doing stand-up, I was like, I could at least be as good as that. Like, and when he said that, I was thinking, you know, I was thinking kind of the same thing last night when some of your opening acts were going on. I had that same thought. When they were performing, saying, like, I'm pretty sure I could be at least at that level.
Yeah.
And so that kind of started in motion. I was like, I'm going to do that someday. And then I told my friend, and he went to this, you know, Big Ben, this place here in Stockholm. And I thought he was trying to get me on for like the following week. And in fact, he was. But instead, he went to Thomas and said, hey, my friend's in town. I think he said it was in town, an American comic on vacation or something. So he came back and said, yeah, you're on in 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even have, I had like an hour to prepare, but I'd always had it in my head. So it was more just a matter of finally someone give me a microphone.
I think I saw that gig. I'm not sure why, but I must have been there. This was at the time. Mm-hmm. You did good, right?
Yeah, it went really well. I mean, really well for a first time.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, probably if you look back on it now, okay for for anyone else.
Did you have a set list even or something?
What do you mean, like written down?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I didn't have time for that. But I had, like I said, I had jokes in my head that I'd always, in case anyone ever handed me a microphone on stage. this whole career change and journey, the most amazing thing about it is it really wasn't 100% or even 50% of my own doing. It was more like someone was like, here's a microphone and get up there, and kind of got pushed up on stage. And the same thing with the show. I mean, what happened, that got filmed, I think, the Big Ben performance. And then someone in San Diego, a friend of mine, saw it, and he had it just built a comedy club there. And so he booked me to open for Tom Arnold based on that. So I had only done one gig, and then I got paid for, you know, opening for like six or seven shows with Tom, which is really fun. It was like a total Forrest Gump type moments when I fly out to San Diego and he's like, how long have you been doing comedy? 10 minutes. So then I started doing that for a while. And I met Martin Sonneby, who is a mutual friend of ours. I said to him, I have some TV ideas. And he's like, oh, good. I meet with production companies from time to time. And so I had an idea. It's kind of based, like, it was like this, actually. I wanted to do a kind of a talk show with American and Swedish comedians and show clips of their stand-up interspersed with an interview.
Okay.
It's called You Talk Funny. That was my idea. And he said, I don't like that idea at all. And so I said, well, I have this other idea, this show, Welcome to Sweden, about my life with an American that comes to Sweden. And he liked that idea better and asked me, you know, how far in the script I was. And I actually hadn't written it, but I'd thought about it a lot. So I went home and wrote that script again, based on really his, you know, it's one thing to have an idea, but then we kind of need somebody else sometimes to say not only that they think it's a good idea, but also they think you can do it. He was that person for me, actually, in that sense. Because also, when I pitched it to him, I was saying, and, you know, I thought maybe we could get an American actor to come over and play the role. And he's like, you should do it. You know, it's going to be too expensive for the production company if they think they have to hire an American actor.
Who did you have in mind?
Well, I was thinking of Ben Schwartz, you know, the guy who plays John Ralphio in Parks and Rec.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his in general. And that was what I had in mind when I was thinking of an actor. So that's what was funny. I mean, so when I wrote the script, I still was expecting probably that I wouldn't get, first of all, I didn't know if anybody would read it or like it, but I certainly didn't think that I would get to play it, having no experience whatsoever as an actor.
You do this like in your lunch break or?
Yeah. I wrote the script on a Saturday.
Okay.
Yeah, up in my attic.
All right. So you did it in one day?
Yeah. Okay. I did it in like 4 hours.
Did this actually end up in your show?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was almost, obviously we changed a lot of it around, but it was pretty much the pilot episode of the show. And it was straight from my own life. I mean, when I first came to Sweden, I came straight from the airplane to my now wife's family summer house, met her whole family and drank a lot of aquavit and sang songs and took saunas and things like that. So it was, you know, loosely based on that. And Yeah, it was again, it was kind of in that attic on that day. Not only did I write that script, but I also wrote what I wanted the show to be, how I envisioned it. And I said it was a show we could get a ton of American cameos. We'll sell it in the US and we'll sell it in Sweden. It'll be the first show that's on in both places. Like I was just kind of fucking around, really.
Dreaming big.
Yeah, best case scenario.
Yeah. And by the way,
it all happened.
And by the way, why not do that?
Yeah, I think that's certainly a lesson to be taken from that is you know, oftentimes you limit yourself.
Of course.
In what you think is possible. Yeah, should always be at least starting with the best case scenario.
Exactly.
And I think if you don't call it that too, I think a lot of times people say like, oh, best case scenario. And then, so that means almost something that can't happen. If that's the best case, instead, if you just say like, this is, you know, goals, which is what I kind of wrote there, is this is what I think can happen.
Yeah.
If everything goes right. And it did. Yeah. It was crazy. And then when I met with Felix Herngren, before that meeting, I was so prepared to defend. I wanted to at least be able to audition for the role of Bruce at that point, because I was really into the script and the character. And so I was kind of practicing, like I was up, like coming up with my list of five reasons why I, someone with no experience, can still, you know, be the lead actor in this show, expecting that to be the biggest hurdle in this meeting. Mm. Instead, he came in and said, "Hey, I read the script. I really, really like it. I just had a couple of questions. Like, when you move, it's going to be you, right? You're going to be playing Bruce." And I was like, "Yeah." And that was it. That was the only discussion we had. It turns out later, I learned from people that we filmed auditions for the role of Emma, and those were actually my auditions. So they told me after the fact that they were actually filming me.
Uh-huh, okay.
But I didn't know that. I thought I'd already had the role at that point.
Uh-huh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, it's wild. That story is, I can't imagine it ever have happened almost in any country that someone with no experience at all not only writes a show and stars in it, but also like a produced it and showrunner and, you know, head writer. It's weird.
But you've changed the production company as well.
Yeah.
Along the way.
That was more, I think, when you are as invested in the show as I am and all aspects of it, what you want is the feeling that other people are as well. And when you see people who aren't, you know, giving it their full attention, that can be frustrating. But I think in general, I mean, there wasn't really any sort of, I mean, I know that there's been talk like that there was some sort of huge rift between it, but there was none of that. I mean, it was a pretty amicable split. We just wanted more. Last year, we had kind of shared creative control, and that's tricky. I had final say, but didn't often use it until it was maybe too late. So we wanted to structure this season a little bit with more control.
And when you say we, that's...
That's my sister and I.
Okay.
Yeah. So we found that we're working with Yarovsky, which is a little bit better fit for us.
Okay. Cool. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Before we leave your upbringing totally, I just have to talk a little bit about your middle name. Is it Milmore?
Yes.
It's a fantastic name.
Really? That's the first person that's ever said that.
Well, I've never heard it before.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, it's my mother's maiden name.
Okay.
What's her last name?
And Polar, up? I mean, that doesn't sound very Irish. That sounds German to me.
It is German, but it's my father's stepfather's name.
Okay.
So it's not actually blood relations to us.
So your ancestry is 100%
no,
Irish?
No, it's mixed, you know, like all Americans, is, you know, all sorts of crazy stuff going there.
But no Swiss.
Portuguese, Dutch, Irish, English, a few other things.
Is that your natural color of hair?
No.
No?
I mean, close, I think. But yeah, I get it dyed for the show.
Why is that? Because Bruce...
Gray.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you that old?
I'm that old, yeah.
Oh.
I have like one spot. I have like a Jay Leno spot.
Okay.
That doesn't look good in high def cameras.
Uh-huh, all right. All right.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about the second season? What is new?
Well, it's a new season. I mean, we're winter instead of summer, so it definitely looks different.
Depressing, or
no? We're trying to make it as non-depressing as possible.
That's
shooting during that 1 hour when the sun hits the snow in the perfect light.
Yeah, that 1 hour a month.
Yeah. No, I'm excited about it. I mean, obviously, I'm always fascinated when someone says, like, so how do you think the show's going? Because, you know, I think about the show all day long for months. And then, you know, we write the show for months all day long. And then we shoot it. And then I come home and I'm watching the dailies. And then I'm, you know, I'm editing it. And, like, if at the end of that process, if I was like, yeah, it's not so good, you know, like, it's... I think it's good. Otherwise, I would have changed it by now. So, but then again, you're so close to it that it's impossible to be objective by that point.
When you talk about film, movies, I mean, there's so much people in production that it's actually a miracle that it doesn't, not every movie is a fuck up.
Yeah.
I mean, with the investors and stuff.
Yeah.
I guess it's even though you are, I mean, you're the showrunner, as you say, but still, there's so many other factors that can fuck stuff up.
Yeah. But I do think the job of the showrunner is to try to prevent that from happening and to try to take in all of those voices and hopefully make them add to it, not detract or subtract from the show. I think I've done a much better job of that this year. Last year, I had no idea what I was doing in any phase. So we've kind of streamlined that a bit. Like last year, there was a lot more of input coming from the American and Swedish producers. And then oftentimes those were competing notes. So we've kind of gotten everybody more on the same page, I think, this year. But I think in general, I mean, last year, we structured it very differently. I'm not sure if anyone ever picked up on this, but the show, the 10 episodes, really never involved any other characters. Unlike almost every sitcom nowadays, which has an A, B, and C plot, our episodes last year, we just had like basically Bruce and Bruce and Emma plots the whole time. There was one storyline that didn't involve them, and that's when Bruce went back to New York so that we had to fill the time. And that was a choice we made. It was to make it really only about the two of them and make that season be all about their relationship and his... whether he's staying or not. I think season two, now we've that's done. That story is done. I think now it's structured at least in a more traditional way where we're utilizing the other characters and giving them their own storylines.
What mistakes did you do that you're not going to repeat on this season?
I mean, I think any first season is kind of a feeling out process. I think I have talked to a lot of other showrunners, and they all say that same thing. It's like a miracle if you get to the second season. That's a miracle in and of itself. And then you'll look back on the first season and be like, "Holy crap, was that off?" I'm not at that stage. I don't think. I mean, I'm super proud of the first season. I think we did everything almost that we wanted to do. Of course, now that I look back on each episode, all I see is the things that I would do differently. So I think the way it's shot, we're changing up a bit. We've gone to more moving cameras, moving pictures, rather than kind of the classic stationary camera. So I think it's going to look a lot different, season two, in terms of the movement of the show. But otherwise, it's, yeah, I think we're kind of following the same formula. It's basically the same group back together. And we changed just one writer, really. And Josephine couldn't do it because she was pregnant. So otherwise, it's the same group back again.
But she's back working, of course. And
yeah.
And how old is her child?
I think he is 5 months.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, he's around.
Yeah, all right.
On set.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Seeing a lot of him these days.
Yeah, but that's great. I mean, there should be a baby on every workplace.
Yeah, it's good for the sound people.
Yeah.
They really they're impressed.
I'm still not done with your time in the US, really.
But go for it.
Yeah, because you have like a field of expertise in law. What is that?
I was an intellectual property lawyer, which is like trademarks, copyrights, and patents.
But did you spend time in court ever?
Yeah, I was a litigator. So I just worked on that, like cases basically, trademark cases mainly.
What was your biggest case? Apple versus?
Well, I had a lot of big cases, but I remember my first case was suing Muhammad Ali. Somebody, I forget the specifics of the case, but I remember it was somebody wanted to sell one of his robes that he wore during one of his fights, and there was a dispute over who owned what.
Did you win?
We settled.
Okay.
Yeah, most cases end with settling.
All right.
But I can remember walking into the partner's office and he'd be like, "Oh, here's your first case. Like, you against the most beloved American icon that you can think of."
Yeah.
So that was a good way to start. But no, I liked those cases actually were, as far as litigating goes, trademark and copyright cases tend to be matters that really just need to be figured out, like real disputes that both sides are kind of feel that they're right, which is unusual, I think, in the law. I think a lot of times, especially in litigation, you have a clear kind of good guy, bad guy, and you have to choose one or the other. And generally, the bad guys are the ones that are paying a lot more. But in that field, it's usually just two companies that really need to figure it out.
Now, how did you end up being an expert in that?
Just I took classes in law school and really liked, actually trademark was my favorite class in law school. And so when I was looking for firms, I was looking for firms that specialized in that when I was doing my internship. And then from there, yeah, that was the firm that I was at. It was just that.
Can you use your knowledge in this, in your new career in any way?
A little bit, in the sense of, you know, registering certain trademarks for the show and things like that. I do that myself.
Yeah.
I think I'm a little bit more aware of when we're shooting, you know, when there's products on the table, make sure that it's not facing the camera.
If they don't pay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or if we don't pay.
All right.
One or the other.
Okay.
I think I'm more aware of that than Swedes are, but no, but otherwise, no, there's no real crossover. Other than, I will say, litigating in general, I think, really helps my stand-up career, just in the sense that arguing in front of a judge and there's somebody else there that is trying to literally stop you from, you know, by objecting, the pressure and tension there is so high and it's so nerve-wracking that when I'm up on stage, unless someone's heckling, it feels like a much safer environment in many ways.
But heckling doesn't really happen in Sweden,
right?
Does
exactly.
It?
So in that sense, in terms of nerves, I can always be like, well, at least no one's going to yell out "objection" to one of my jokes.
No,
objection, not funny.
But if you are to heckle Greg Poehler, that's how you do it.
that's the blueprint.
Yeah.
That's actually a really funny heckle now that I think about it.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah. You should try that. College in the US, you have to pay for that in some way.
Yeah.
I guess. How did you do that?
Well, I got a scholarship so that was about half of it.
Why?
Just like an academic scholarship.
Oh, okay.
And they give it to people who, I don't know, qualify for it. And then my parents paid the other half.
Yeah.
They pay for both of us to go through.
So you don't have CSN or some equivalent?
For loans, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I had to do that for law school.
Okay.
Law school, I took out loans myself.
Did you get education in Sweden as well?
Yeah, I when I moved here, I got my master's at Stockholm University for European intellectual property law.
Okay. So you could actually do some of that stuff here as well?
Maybe. I guess in theory, but I haven't done much of it.
No. And that's behind you now.
I guess. I mean, I guess that's my fallback.
Yeah.
That's my worst case scenario, I think.
I know that you're settled here now, and as we said, you have three children, but is there a plan to ever go back to the U.S.?
Well, our plan has always been, once the kids go off to college, which we're assuming would be in the U.S., that we would kind of follow. Unfortunately, we keep having more kids, so that keeps getting longer and longer.
But is there even more coming?
No, but I mean, our daughter's two, so that's now that's 16 years from now.
Yeah.
Whereas my son is 10, so it would have been 8 years if we had stopped.
Yeah.
I don't know. We bought a house in Florida with my parents, actually.
Okay.
So they're there now, and we go back quite a bit there and to Boston, and I'm in LA quite a bit now. So it feels like we're kind of straddling both countries.
Or in LA for work reasons. So,
yeah.
Your show was picked up by NBC, right?
Yeah.
And that's a fantastic thing for Swedish. And that must be like, that's never happened.
Yeah, before. I think it's the first ever European show, I think, on an American major network. I don't want to be, I'm sure somebody's going to double check that and call me a liar, but I think it's true.
Yeah,
because even like the British shows, you know, growing up, like Monty Python and those type of stuff, and even like the, you know, The Office, they either remake or it's on PBS or cable or something. So
okay, so it couldn't have happened in a better way, or.
Yeah, and I mean, also with the subtitles too. I think it's definitely the first show with subtitles on American major network. Yeah, it was crazy. I mean, like I said, it was always part of my plan was to try to sell it to the U.S. And we had some interest from Netflix early on, actually an offer from them when we were making it. So we knew when we were making the show that it was going to at least be there and have a U.S. Audience. And then I was always thinking of a smaller cable network,
actually. FX or.
Not even that. I was thinking more like smaller.
Okay.
So one of those obscure channels at the end of the cable box. And then when NBC became interested, it was a total dream come true. It was crazy. And for me, they basically signed an option with us, whereas, you know, they saw the mini pilot that we put together but didn't officially agree to air it until we delivered all the episodes. So that was the ultimate validation for me, was that they watched the whole season and then said, yeah, like, we really like this and we really want it to be on. So,
and it did really well.
Yeah, it did well there. Yeah.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got a second season, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
But aren't you rich now?
Now we're back on me instead of my wife.
But, no. I mean, NBC, it sounds like it's going to be. I mean, since you do everything yourself as well.
Yeah.
It must be a huge pile of money.
Yeah.
For that.
I guess. It's more about the non-monetary gains.
You're so Swedish now that you can't even discuss money.
No, it's, yeah, I'm doing okay.
Yeah. You have a fresh T-shirt. It looks new.
Thank you. It's a very expensive T-shirt.
Yeah.
Very,
yeah. Speaking of which, you've been living here for next year is going to be 10 years, right?
Yeah.
How Swedish do you feel?
I feel very Swedish when I'm in the U.S. and I feel very American when I'm here. I would say I'm somewhere in between, Swamerican or something. But I'm going to become a citizen, I think, soon. I sent in my paperwork finally.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does that
mean? They say yes. I don't know.
All right.
What the process is.
Is that a good thing for you legally?
It doesn't really affect me legally.
Because if you do it the other way around, it's going to be you're going to be double taxed for the rest of your life, and you,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I get that anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to pay both places.
That sucks.
Yeah,
that's why you're not filthy rich.
That's why I'm not discussing it. No, I mean, Sweden taxes are generally high enough that you don't have to pay American taxes. But
so, in terms of Swedishness, how, I mean, are you a feminist, for instance?
I hope everybody is.
Yeah.
That word, I don't quite understand that people who say they're not. I mean,
everybody aren't, I can tell you.
Yeah, but I mean, it depends on how you phrase the, but if you say, are you feminist, some people would say no, but then you say, well, do you think, women should be entitled to the same things as men? And people are like, oh yeah, of course. And it's like, okay, that's kind of the definition.
Exactly.
So I think it's just the word maybe that turns people off.
It might be, yeah. Do you bore your American friends with how great our free kindergarten system is as well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I paint a rosy picture.
Yeah, you do, but that's a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, the Swedish taxes are crazy high, but you at least can tangibly see what they're being used for, in terms of your kids' daycare is free and their schooling is free and healthcare and things like that. Whereas if you, in the American system, of course, you get more money back, but then you have to have all these extra things that you're paying. And so if you did the calculations, I bet you it would come out about equal, actually, in terms of, what you're paying for.
Yeah, of course.
It's interesting to see.
Yeah, but it also, I mean, I have friends, Swedes living in the U.S., and it always ends up with the woman being at home because it's too expensive to have children in kindergarten and so forth. And also what's that called? It's called samtaxering in Swedish, I think. I mean, that once you're married, that you are taxed together.
Yeah.
We had that too, but I think we stopped doing that in the 60s or something like that.
Mm.
So in terms of equality, I would guess that Sweden has come further.
I would guess so. Yeah, I would assume so. And I think in general, especially when it comes to like co-parenting, I think this place really figured it out. I mean, I was on paternity leave with all three of my kids. And when I try to describe that to my American friends, they just can't even they don't get it. Maybe even the concept of staying at home for an extended period of time. It's so different there.
And you were like, yeah, I was home for 6 months. 6 months?
Yeah.
Not 6 hours?
yeah. So that's nice. I think that's the good thing about living here is you do feel like you're kind of a little bit more connected familially. Family-wise.
But you've said in the interviews that you sort of miss having friends. And is it still like that, or do you?
Yeah, I mean, most of my friends here are Americans. I have very few Swedish friends, for whatever reason.
Is it because you're cocky?
Because you're a cock? Is it because you're an asshole, perhaps? No, I think a lot of it is the English, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I can speak Swedish, but I'm terrible at it. So if I start that way, I'll generally tend to, by the end of the night, be speaking English and forcing somebody else to. And I think there's something about that maybe people, don't mind hanging out with me for short periods of time, but not long periods here.
I can be your friend.
Or it could just be I'm an asshole.
Well,
I can be your friend. Thank you.
Yeah, you're
That's
welcome.
Sweet.
If I get some of your bed money.
Some of it tends to fall off during the night. I think you can just come by.
You're unique in that way that you have a show that's running both in the US and Sweden. In what way would you say that people react differently to it?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I think the show itself is almost like a sociological experiment to see, what people take away from it. And I think in general, I mean, I think partly because it was my first show and I was kind of intensely diabolical and figuring out what people were saying. I mean, there's nobody that knows more about what people think of my show than I do. I've read everything, like on everything, every tweet, every blog, every article in both places. And we're on in a bunch of different countries too. I've even read those articles. Google translated them.
Okay, yeah.
And I think in general, when it comes to the audience is pretty consistent in all these countries. We tend to have about like 80% people that really like it, 10% that don't really care, 10% that think it's the worst show they've ever seen.
Uh-huh, okay.
Which is odd to me that happens. But I think that's almost as good as you can do for a comedy is batting around 80%. So I'm super happy with it. I think the interesting, like if you look at critics in the U.S., we did really great. And, you know, again, like 80-something percent of all the reviews there, if you go to like Rotten Tomatoes. But they were viewed as like this really low-key, subtle, charming show. Swedish critics like think that we're way over the top slapstick. That's fascinating to me, mm-hmm. to see the same show being perceived so radically different.
And it's also fascinating in a way, because I think that Sweden, in comparison with, for instance, Germany or so, we're so brought up with American comedy. I mean, everything on television is American, and everything, I mean, everybody knows, everybody's seen more American television here than Swedish almost.
Yeah.
So it's sort of strange that there is a difference in, but maybe it's, if it would have been, if your show would have been American altogether,
it might have been perceived differently here.
Exactly.
Maybe, yeah.
You also said that you are working on a movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm writing a movie with Cecilia Forsch.
Uh-huh. Forsch. Yeah. Fantastic actress.
Yeah, she's great.
Very,
it's
very,
kind
very
of a reverse.
Beautiful.
It's
also
about a Swedish actress that moves to L.A. She's great. It's called Saga. So I'll hopefully be done with that and pitching it in June when I'm out there.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Good luck with that.
Thanks. I'm developing something else with Ulf Kvensler as well, which is based on a Swedish idea of his that we're going to try to sell in the U.S. as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. It's a good time now for Swedes in LA, it seems.
Yeah, Sweden's a hot brand.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, being in Los Angeles, it's sort of every other person that you meet is a Swedish. So you can't really talk shit about people anymore behind their backs. Can I ask you, because you knew when you decided to write the show and sort of do comedy instead, you knew that you would be compared to your sister, of course.
Mm.
Does that sort of piss you off that you still have to sort of relate to her in any given situation?
I think it's
like this.
It's good and bad. I think there's good parts and bad parts of it. I mean, the good part, of course, is I don't think anybody would have given me the chance, actually, if it wasn't for that. I think I got a lot of benefit of the doubt, which, like, well, let's hope there's something else in that family, some level of talent. And I think it draws more attention to the show because of that, which is good. And, you know,
and it's also, I guess it helped, her name helped when you sold it to the U.S. and so forth, of course.
Of course, her name helped to get the meeting with NBC, certainly. They would have never gone by their desk otherwise. So yeah, I mean, it helped me certainly get my foot in the door. And to be known as Amy Poehler's brother is great. I mean, you know, I'm fine with that. I love her, so it's better than being like Charles Manson's brother, I guess.
I wouldn't assume so.
Maybe, I don't know. I hear he's a great guy, his brother. But the flip side of that, of course, is like you're saying, you know, like a lot of reviews sometimes last year were like, and I think the New York Times review in general, which I always think about because it was a really great review, actually. They really liked the show, they liked the characters. But they were like, but you know, he's the weak link, you know, and he's not as good as his sister. And a couple like that, it's like, oh, man, I hope I'm not as good as she is. That would be, imagine how badly that would speak of her, someone who's been doing it for 20-something years, to have her brother just on his first try be better.
Yeah.
I think there's no other job where someone would expect you to be as good as someone who's been doing it for 20 years. And so I think that those comparisons are a little unfair for that reason, just for experience reasons, and also because my character is more of the straight guy in the show as well. So it's not, I'm not trying to be overtly comical in my role. So yeah, and also, you know, a little bit of a chip on my shoulder like, which maybe you sensed when that last question, when the NBC question, because, you know, I do sense that, you know, that feeling is out there in terms of, you know, a lot of people saying like, oh, you know, she got her brother a show, like, you know, she went to NBC and said, I want my brother's show on. Whereas to me, knowing how hard I worked on the show and then delivering all the episodes to them and having them watch it and having them really base their decision on the actual show, the content of the show. Like I said, of course, the only reason why they watched it is because of her and her connections. But I feel like I really earned that myself in terms of getting it on the air there. And the success of the show, I feel, you know, is a result of a lot of my own hard work. Mm. So when you work on something so hard and so diligently and for so long, and then someone says like, it's her show, or you're the only reason why you got it is because of the connections. Of course, it's hurtful.
But on the other hand, I mean, not to sort of take down what you're saying, but I mean, if you have, when your movie is out and your next show is out and you are on season 7 of Welcome to Sweden, I mean, it's going to be a different thing, but you're still going to, I mean, as you say, you've been in the business for like 2 years.
Yeah.
And she's been in it for 20. It's, of course, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll always be, I can't imagine, I think it's a, it will be difficult for me to overcome that and not always be viewed as just her brother. And like I said, I'm actually generally fine with that. It's not something that bothers me. It bothers me more when you know, the perception that I feel maybe sometimes that people think that the show itself is kind of the result of her connections. But there's nothing I can do about that. And also, when it comes to comparisons, I mean, like I said, like that New York Times article, for example, you know, they praise the show, they praise the other characters, and the scripts, and I mean, I did all that, you know. It's like, but he's not funny. Is the thing? It's like, okay, but I made those characters and wrote those lines, so my character's not funny, maybe, but. I'd like a little more credit there. So yeah, I think in general, I mean, not just when it comes to my sister's connections and things like that, but the stage I'm in right now in general is somewhere in between being unbelievably thankful and have so much gratitude for being given the opportunity to do it. And then the flip side is a huge chip on my shoulder because I've been working so hard, you know, that, you know, it becomes almost defensive in many ways.
Yeah.
So I'm somewhere in between. Like, I, you know, by the hour, I kind of change my moods depending on how I'm feeling.
But isn't it also? I mean, because you seem to be really rational about the bad critique that you get. But isn't it like that for everybody? That you can get 1,500 positive tweets, but it's still going to be the two.
Yeah, no doubt.
Bad ones.
I'm still thinking about it. Was one. One guy wrote like last year, like that he just didn't like my face. He said, watching Welcome to Sweden, it's okay. I just can't stand the main character's face or something like that. And like, for some reason, I can't stop thinking about that tweet. Like, what is with my face? Is it that offensive that you would, you know, take the time to craft a tweet about it? I find that interesting. But no, it's certainly... Especially, it's not just because, you know, there's a bad or negative review. And if you're an actor, I think it's easier. But for me, I mean, I, like I said, I produce the show, I show run it, I write it, I come home, I shoot, I come home. Like my days now, we shoot basically 12-hour days or so. And then I come home and I watch the dailies from the night before and I'm trying to get better and editing it as well, or helping edit, and so at the end of that, there's so much work that goes in, and you're making something you think is good, or at least not terrible, that when somebody else says that they hate it, it's really personal. Yeah. More so than like anything else could be. It's, you know, it's like working on a painting for 18 months and crafting it, you know, just the way you want it, and then finally unveiling it and having someone be like, ooh, that's terrible. You begin to question your own taste.
Mm.
But luckily, the good ones and the good tweets, it's still worth for me to scroll through. I haven't gotten to the stage where the bad ones totally cancel out the good ones. But you need like the ratio to be about 9 to 1 for it to be worth it, because the one is you know, the one bad one is 10 times as hurtful as the good ones are good.
I had to move our interview 1 week, and then I said that I hate myself for doing that, and you said, well, something funny back, and you said, just keep hating yourself.
Yeah, but for other reasons, not
for exactly
this. Yeah.
But and I said that don't worry, I'm Swedish. And I sort of thought that was a Swedish thing, because if I would generalize, I would say that Americans seem more confident, but I mean, it's still, because this is a confidence thing, right? That you, the bad critique sort of sticks so hard with you.
Yeah, I think it's less about confidence. It's just so, like I said, when you work on something that you think you make it, that you think is good, to see somebody else, it's something about tweeting too. It's like, it's another level of somebody doesn't like it so much that they're writing about it, but how much they don't like it. Yeah, it stinks, but I'm so much better at it now. Now I can laugh those off, you know, the I don't like his face tweets, much easier than I did when I started. Because I mean, there's no other really business. Like, if people don't like your face, I bet you there's been a lot of people that haven't liked my face throughout my years. It's just nobody has told me. Or said it aloud.
Objection, Your Honor. That's an ugly face.
Objection. I don't like that guy's face. So that's part of the deal, I think, with once you get into this business, is, you know, it's going to happen, but it's hard to prepare for.
Overruled.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you like to recommend something?
Well, let's tie this all together into this interview. I would say I would like to recommend for people to really think about what they want to do in life. And I think, before I did this, you know, whenever I heard about someone who said, follow your dreams, you know, it felt so ridiculously cliche. And my father used to, I remember watching a show with my father when somebody was saying that, and he was like, oh, give me a break, follow your dreams. The only people who say that are people who became successful. You never hear the person who followed their dreams and didn't make it. And he was like, those people would be, take the job, you know, take the steady job. But the more I've thought about it, I think the more wrong he is actually about that, and that even the people who have pursued what they wanted to do and failed, they still feel better than the person who didn't try at all and took the steady route, the steady job. So I just think I would recommend people figure out what makes them happy and what they really want to do. And it doesn't have to be as drastic as what we did as far as a career change. It can be something, you know, that you just, it's a hobby, you want to learn how to play the piano, but it's never too late to do it. I mean, I think we're proof of that as we embark on our middle age careers and lives. And there's the tendency, I think, to think that it's too late and that you missed it. You missed the opportunity, but I'm certainly proof that that's not true.
We should have a late bloomers club or something.
Yeah, I like it. It'd be me and you and Charles Manson's brother.
Exactly. who do you think I should interview on Varvet?
You know who's interesting? You might want to check it out. Is Abby Cornish? You know, she's an Australian actress. She was RoboCop's wife in the latest.
Ah, okay.
She's Kinnaman's wife in RoboCop.
All right.
And has been in a lot of films, but has recently embarked on a rap music career.
Fantastic.
Yeah. She's got a lot going on.
Like a Joaquin Phoenix thing, but in reality.
But real, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've seen a bit of her. She's got a lot of good things going on. She's an interesting person.
Do you have a number?
I do, yeah. We can set that up.
Perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, man. It's good to be here.
Greg Poehler, ladies and gentlemen. And I have to say that I'm pretty impressed that he just did this amazing thing, that he just made this series and that it's actually working, like, in both continents. That's super impressive. He's Greg Poehler on Twitter, and he's gpoles22 on Instagram. Myself is VarvetPod on both Twitter and Instagram. And I would like to thank Uber for sponsoring the show. I would like to thank Lovisa Olsson for editing and Christina Jörling Biro for producing. Hope to speak to you again in 2 weeks. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.